Hello and welcome to Boomeranging, from expat to repat, a podcast that explores the question, what could be so hard about returning home after years living overseas? I'm your host, Margot Anderson, and in each episode, I will sit down with a former Aussie expat to discuss how they survived repatriation and reverse culture shock, how they navigated the logistics of careers, friends, and family to successfully find their new place at home, and all without losing their global spirit. If you have just returned home, are thinking about it, or just love a good yarn told by professional globetrotters, then I have no doubt you'll enjoy meeting this diverse group of Australians. When Angela left Australia at age 29, she knew she would be gone longer than 2 years. With expat parents and grandparents, a life overseas was always on the cards. But she didn't know that it would be 22 years, or that her time overseas would include 13 years in Bahrain, or that when she eventually came home, she would change her professional identity completely. For someone who had always worked in recruitment and talent development, and whose career had led her family's choice of where to live, changing her career path was particularly profound. It was also the result of an evolution, not revolution. Angela and I talk about how coming home to Australia and starting again forced her to evaluate her career path and the turn it took next. We talk about her philosophy of saying yes to everything to build knowledge and networks, and how it's okay for someone who manages careers to ask for help managing their own. So welcome, Angela.
Thanks, Margot. Lovely to be here.
Great to have you on the podcast. I'm really looking forward to this. Now, before we dive into your international story, I would love you to take us back to what life and career looked like for you pre-London and pre-Bahrain.
Sure. It was a bit of a mix. When I left high school and went to college, I studied hotel management. I wanted a career in hospitality, which I did for 7 years. But then life took a massive turn when I moved interstate and lived in Adelaide for a year. And that's when my hospitality career ended. And I started working in recruitment. I joined a big firm called Morgan & Banks, which I loved, and it introduced me to the world of recruiting. I didn't know what recruiting was at that time, but I learned that I was pretty good at it. And that's when my career turned down that avenue. I moved back to Sydney, had some time working with the organization Sydney, and then moved with them to London, where it was the same brand, but a really different work environment.
Yeah.
I was living in Sydney, apart from that year in Adelaide, and had friends, busy social life, was pretty active, pretty much normal thing for a 20-something back then.
Now, we sort of heard earlier that the expat career or life overseas almost seemed predestined for you with coming from a family of expats. But do you think that had always inspired you to live overseas? Like, is that where the drive came from, or did you always know?
Look, I think there's something for those of us who are lucky enough to be born with dual passports. My parents moved here as 10-pound-pons at the end of the 60s, and so I had their lived experience, but I also knew that I had the fortune of having a dual passport. So while a lot of my contemporaries were going overseas for their two-year working holiday, pulling pints in pubs in Fulham, I knew that I had the luxury and, I don't know, the fortune to be able to stay as long as I needed or wanted to. And in a way, I think that was a blessing and a curse. So yes, it was definitely something that was part of my experience growing up. We'd talk to family and grandparents and cousins overseas, and I would imagine this place where they all lived, where there were white Christmases and Marks and Spencers. And it just took me a while to get there. You know, a lot of people went over when they finished uni or whatever, and I did it much later in life.
Which is, you know, as you say, a blessing and, you know, potentially a curse. But I think, you know, having the time or the freedom of time to make that decision makes it a considered one. And you also got to go with the benefit of a career or some skills behind you. So you board the plane, you land in London. I think you spent nearly 10 years there. How did that unfold for you?
I used to say that things happen to you when you're living in London that would never happen to you anywhere else in the world. And I mean that in just a way. You just think, that happened? I met that person and we went where? And I think anyone who's had that experience will probably be listening and nodding their head. But it was a real mix. And for somebody who'd grown up for all intents and purposes, in an English household, landing in England was a massive culture shock. I learned really quickly that although I was working for the same organisation, things worked really differently around here when I got there. And I learned one of the supreme crimes in England is to be too earnest. I was very earnest. And I had to learn how to sort of shake that off a bit to win friends and influence people. And it's where I learned that everything happens outside in the smoking area or in the pub. And so I had to learn an awful lot really quickly and undo some of the learning that had sort of served me well up until that point. But I also said yes to a lot of things. I think initially I did that because I was curious, and then I might have done it because I wanted to fit in. There was a lot of trying to fit in over the years. And then it was just, I knew that there were more opportunities to be had. So my career changed slightly. I ended up working for some other recruitment firms, and then I moved to Skype for a brief while, and then I moved to EY, which, as you know, lasted 16 years. And I had more than my fair share of house shares. I actually don't think I was a very good housemate when I look back on it, but I lived in lots of different parts of London and got used to all the different tube routes. And I remember lots of fun and adventures, but it also was hard. It was hard, and I consciously chose to go on my own. I chose to leave a relationship in order to follow this dream of living abroad, and I intentionally wanted to do it on my own. I saw people go off in couples, and, you know, while that worked for them, I knew for me it would be limiting, and I wanted to be free to have experiences, to travel, to meet people that I otherwise might not. I just learned to pay attention to signs, to emotional signs, to opportunities that came my way, and see those as guiding me to what was coming next. I think it's only just talking about it now that I recognize that, but it's definitely something. In the absence of your working visa ends, you've got to go home, someone's dead or dying, in the absence of those markers that, better or worse, other people are guided by, I was really tapping into the signals that I was coming up within me. And the opportunities that were coming up around me.
And you did go over single, but you did meet your husband in the UK. So that was towards the tail end of the 10 years? Was it, that was prior to going to Bahrain, or?
It was prior to going to Bahrain. We met, oh my goodness, it's so stereotypical, at a Christmas party.
Under the mistletoe.
Under the mistletoe at a Christmas party in Clapham. Yep, that was our story. That's where we met. And I wasn't the least bit interested in meeting somebody. I was very much single, and there we are.
So you do manage to persuade him, though, to move to Bahrain. He's English. Yeah, so this was, to some degree, a bit of an adventure for him living somewhere else. But it was for your role that you moved. How did the Bahrain opportunity come up? You're inside EY in London, and they talked to you about Bahrain, yeah?
Oh, gosh, Margot, this is going back to what I just said about the opportunities and listening to what's coming up. The thing that happens to you in London is that when you reach a certain age, it's usually around 33, everyone starts to leave London and say they get married or they have kids and they move out. And that's great. But for me, that wasn't going to be part of my life. And I felt that I'd had an amazing time and I was ready for a change, but I wasn't ready to come home. And so absolutely consciously, I thought, well, what's next? Parallel to that, at EY, there was a request to meet the head of the Middle East HR function to talk about some of the work we'd done in the UK. And I saw that request come through. I saw that email from my boss and I thought, I'll do this. It might lead to something. And it took months and I had no idea what was coming, but I applied for a job. There was some transformation going on and I was fortunate enough to get it. And it was based in Bahrain. And I had the interview lined up and I remember going out for dinner with Julian, he was my fiance at the time, and saying to him, you think about the Middle East as a, you know, place for career opportunities. And he said, well, I hear things are going well over there. It would be exciting. And I said, well, I'm really glad to hear you say that because I've got a job interview on Monday. and look, he had a great career at the time. He was working for a global organization in London in his field. And while he really loved the work, he wasn't sold on the organisation. So for him, there was an openness to the new and finding out what would lie ahead as well. So I suppose I did lead the way, but I didn't have to nudge him too hard. He was quite happy to follow and see what would come for us both.
And so Bahrain was clearly something that you both enjoyed and loved. You had 13 years there. Can you share with us a little bit about what life looked like in Bahrain for both of you?
It's a beautiful place. And it took me a while to come to that point to say that. In the beginning, I was very consumed with my job. I had to travel a lot. I wasn't around that much to get involved in what was going on in my immediate environment. I was really concerned with getting feet first into work and doing my job. So it took me a while to really love and appreciate the place, but it's just so different to other countries in the GCC. You feel like you're in the Middle East. You hear the call to prayer 5 times a day. You are surrounded by colleagues, neighbours, people in every part of life that are Bahraini or from other parts of the world, which I think is a little different, say, to the UAE, where that's not so much the case. And it just felt like I'm really in this country where I feel like I'm in a foreign land. People are so warm. I've never felt safer living anywhere else before. I don't think we locked our car or our house for about 10 years. We just came to appreciate that although you don't have your family with you when you live this expat life, your friends can really become your family, and those relationships are so deep and so important. And you learn to roll with the comings and goings, the great losses and the sadnesses and the joy of people having their own experiences. And it's just really touching, and it's very different to what life felt like in London and what life feels like now that we're back here in Australia. It's just different. But as a country, I think they are warm, generous, kind, respectful, beautiful culture. It's not perfect, no, but we felt very welcome, very safe, very connected, and very fortunate. I have to say, doing a global job from that location, you have the luxury of being able to cross time zones, great flight connections, amazing places to travel when you want a holiday. As my South African friend would say, we landed with our bum in the butter.
Yeah. It's a privilege, isn't it?
It really was. And it also showed us about all the misconceptions that we hear, you know, Western culture about that part of the world and some of the real nuances and things that you just couldn't even expect to understand about the way things are and how cultures operate. I just feel so incredibly lucky to have had that experience and to have had much sunburn there and to grow up for him. He doesn't see skin colour. He doesn't see racial differences. He doesn't see religious differences. I think that's an absolute gift that we could never have scripted.
So after 13 years or potentially earlier, you start to turn your attention to life in Australia or the possibility of life in Australia. What prompted those thoughts of coming home?
Partially it was my son and thinking what kind of life would we like him to have? And he has two little cousins who are now 5 minutes away that we thought, well, we have this opportunity to give him that experience. I didn't have any cousins or grandparents around when I was growing up, and for me, I wanted him to have that experience and also just to see what life was like where I'd grown up. He was very familiar with the UK. We travelled there a lot. So it was just an opportunity to grow up around family that was part of the catalyst. I never would have ruled out going somewhere else, but this was always the end destination. And Julian was obviously on board with that, and so we discussed for some time that when we move, and I had had for a long time, I'd had signals that my role would end up being offshored, which it was. So we'd agreed that when this happens, this is the direction of travel. Unless something else lands in our laps, this is what's going to happen. And we decided on Brisbane because although I wasn't brought up here, my sister lives here, and we knew that having retired parents, they could be more flexible, and that the kids going to school together would just be a fantastic thing to set out. You know, and we didn't know precisely when it would happen, but we knew the direction of travel. And I think for a couple of years we talked about it. There was obviously the pandemic in the middle of it all. But I knew, so, my goodness, just talking to you now, just thinking about how it happened. It was in January 2021. In fact, it was the 12th of January 2021 when I got the call about my role changing. And I just remember going home to Julian and saying to him, it's happening. And so we'd kind of set up our intention well before the change happened without really knowing when, but knowing that when the trigger came, this is what we would do. It actually then took a year for us to do it with, you know, the pandemic and other work and everything else going on. So the timing was kind of quirky in that respect, but at least then we had a concrete plan. The work was ending and we had time to adjust to the idea, time to offload a whole lot of stuff. I was given very strict instructions about what size container we would be shipping back.
Oh, that's always hard.
Still managed to get in a big piece of furniture on the last day.
Excellent. And for your son, like he had never lived in Australia. So he was, what, about 8 or 9 when you were making that decision. What was his response to moving to Australia? Because it's, to all intents and purposes, it's not moving home for him.
No, I think at that age, there's obviously a lot that you get and a lot that you just don't know what will happen. And that's part of the reason why I sort of gave up my corporate job when we moved back, because I just wanted to be around. I wasn't quite sure how the transition would go for him. Julian was still living in Bahrain. His visa took a long time to come. And I knew that if I was working, I'd probably prioritize the job and I needed to be there for him. So I'd say for most of last year, he would say, "Mummy, when are we going home? When are we going back to Bahrain? Why are we here?" There was one day when I said, "Well, we're here so we could spend time with Granny and Poppy and you can get to know your family." He said, "I already know them. Why can't we go back?
What's next?"
and he grew his early years with an awful lot of freedom and a lot of friends and a very active social community. So while he was rebuilding that, he missed it dearly. And things work differently here. And although you're not from around here, you look like you are. And so nobody around you really understands that your frame of reference is wholly different. And look, as an 8-year-old, you don't even have the language to explain that. I'd say he has transitioned really, really well. I think I hadn't appreciated how long it takes kids to shift, because this is my first experience with a young person making a new life as well. So I hadn't really appreciated the time it would take. But he's done brilliantly. He has a great relationship with his cousins. They fight just like siblings and they play just like siblings. So I think that's just brilliant. He's gotten into AFL and cricket and just, I think, doing as well as can possibly be expected. Yeah, he's still obviously, it's still a change, but he's asking less and less when we're going back to Bahrain. But to him, that's home.
So before you left, you obviously thought consciously about changing it up from a career perspective, whether or not that intended to be a break or to pursue a different path. I'm interested how things have unfolded since you've arrived back in Brisbane. Again, you, as you sort of said earlier, it's not a place you were from, so it's not naturally a network to return to. How did you, I guess, approach networking and understanding the job market? You know, did you put your recruiter hat on and kind of explore it through that lens? Or, you know, I'm interested in what your experience and insights were.
What a great question, Margot. I think my recruiter hat was almost a hindrance because I knew how arbitrary some decisions could be when it came to hiring. I think I was acutely aware that I'd been away for a long, long time. And it was important not to be that outsider coming back saying, here's all the stuff I know and can do. I really felt that I'd been away for a long time. Things had changed. The landscape had changed. The work life had changed, particularly with the pandemic. And the best thing I could do was have conversations with people and understand what they were dealing with, what their workplaces were dealing with, what issues their leaders were dealing with, and what were the topics of conversation going on in business here in Australia. And so I just decided to immerse myself in conversations. And look, as a connector, that's one of my top strengths. I decided that that would help me out, and just be ever curious. And I didn't know what would happen professionally. And look, that's still shaping. But I just decided to get stuck in and have the conversations and pretty much to say yes to every opportunity that came my way. One, because I figured I could handle it. And two, this was the best way to learn and find out. And it would counter that real sense of fear and anxiety of being here and being new, not looking like I was new, but really having a very different frame of reference. And I did get invitations to events, to meetings, to speak, to be involved in things. And I just said yes to everything. And there was a moment, I think we'd been here about 6-7 months, and I happened to say to Julian in passing, well, I know I'm not working, but, and he just looked at me and he said, what do you mean you're not working? You're just doing stuff all the time. But for me, not being an employee is a very different identity. Although I was actively engaged and I built a small coaching practice and was working in a consulting capacity, it just felt like it wasn't work with a capital W because I wasn't an employee anymore. And that's taken quite some time to see and adjust to.
I think it's really about how we give ourselves permission to look at work and what role it plays in our life, because for so long we've been on the treadmill and it's been very clearly defined and reinforced and, you know, all those things inside a corporate landscape. So it is a real change. I think I remember you saying, like, it's very much like following a rope one grip at a time, which is a lovely way to think about it, you know, just edging along and applying that lens of curiosity.
It's what kept me going, knowing that I didn't have to know the end, but I just had to keep that forward motion and that curiosity. Tapping into my strengths was going to help me through the unknown, and does help me through the unknown. That was really motivation, fuel. I obviously gained a lot of insight and ton of connections. And I just found it so interesting hearing what people were consumed by and talking about, worried about, adapting to post-pandemic work life. And I hadn't had an awful lot to do with the Australian working landscape during their time overseas. So it was a great education.
And I think that's really important to think about, how do we educate ourselves when we return? It's a big part of what we talk to around our network mapping and market mapping is, you know, the purpose of conversations is not always to get a job. It's actually to educate yourself on what's actually happening. So it's such an important lens. I'm interested, how long did you do this before, you know, you sought external help in sort of refining what you wanted to do?
I think you and I had spoken when I was still in Bahrain, and my goodness, was I relieved to know that there's somebody doing what you do, not just with the talent consulting, but actually bringing people like me together. I can't tell you how much it gave me a sense of assurance to know this. You know, there's a place where I can go meet people who've had this experience. It really, really was important to me. But I also knew, as someone who's had a career in talent and career in careers, I knew that if I just tried to do everything myself, I wouldn't be doing the best work. And so once I felt I had, you know, set up the house, unpacked the container, got my son into school, you know, made a few connections and friends, I felt a little bit steady. My husband and the dog were here. I thought, right, it's time to get some professional help and some real focused assistance that not only took into account the professional challenges and changes, but actually understood what it's like to come back from a career overseas. So, you know, when I picked up the phone to you, it's like, actually, of all the people that I can go to, you're it. Please open up some time in your diary. Because I was so conscious, having been a recruiter for so many years and dealing with people who'd lived and worked all over the world, I just knew that being able to translate what you've done over here, what you've done in the Middle East, what you've done at the global level into the Australian market was going to be a really important lens. And not many people can do that and can see that and understand just the vulnerability of being in that position. So I would say how long? It might have been 5 or 6 months. And I think it was just one of those things I knew that I needed to do. And I just couldn't kick the can down the road anymore. There was a steady ship here and that it was time to tackle it. But I did feel very much that I needed the right expertise and I needed to feel like I could have an open, safe conversation. So it wasn't just about a paper exercise. It was really about the conversation.
So what's it like, I guess, flipping the hat and being the student, you know, basically you're receiving career advice when you've had a career of helping others manage theirs.
I know. Oh, it's actually really nice. Yeah. Knowing that it's not you that's got to have the answer. Someone else is going to help you out. And also there's just a safety in thinking this person can see my blind spots. The things that I don't know. This individual can help me to see those and help me to talk to them, which I think is one of the most critical things that you're able to help me with. How do I talk to the fact that I was in a country that most people here have never even heard of, never mind can point it out on a map, and what life looked like and how I actually had an international career from there and how that actually relates to what I can do here. So, yeah, that was a big part of it.
I think, you know, one of the things that I've always been really conscious of is that, you know, yes, there's some bespoke advice, but there is that community, as you've said before, that you can tap into who share those experiences, share those vulnerabilities. And, you know, with the size of the community now, invariably it's about being able to say, okay, you can test this out with a couple of people who've gone before you and we can connect you to that, you know. So I think that's the power of something greater than an individual, you know, having that community to tap into.
You know, it really meant a lot to me and still does, and not just for me but also my husband. And there's something about it when you've had a particular life experience, other people can recognize it. I just remember this incident. I was over in the dog park one day, just chatting. Actually, our dog hadn't arrived yet. I was just taking my son to play with some other people's dogs. But chatting with a lady, and I mentioned that we'd only recently arrived, and she just looked at me in the eyes and she said, "How are you?" It's like, oh. I said, "Where did you move from?" And she'd spent 9 years in Japan. But she just heard one or two sentences from me, and she knew, and she just said, and I think that ability to connect five steps ahead with someone when you have that shared experience, whether it's living overseas or living, you know, any other pivotal life experience, having people around you who can help you feel connected, it's like a buoyancy vest for a while you're bobbing along in the ocean waiting to get to the next shore. And those connections for me are and have been very important. And important when we lived overseas too. I think the challenge is when you come home, you're different, but you just don't look different.
And there's a lot of assumptions that are made. People assume that you know how everything works here or what's happening or, you know, so that journey of reconnecting to life and to career and to business is just people don't volunteer their help because they can't see it. It's not obvious. So switching to today, what does your portfolio career look like?
Funny you should ask, because I was just reviewing my bio earlier this week, and actually quite a lot's happened. One of the things that I've been doing for about 11, 12 years now, in amongst my day job, has been leadership and performance coaching. And when I came back, although I left sort of corporate role aside for one time, work that did come to me was all in the coaching area. And so saying yes to everything, I said yes to the coaching. And what I noticed was I just love working with people in that way. It lights me up. Elements of my day job had faded. And I slowly began to realize that the work coaching leaders or aspiring leaders, facilitating leadership growth and development was something that I had grown into and actually was able to really impact people through. So in terms of how this shaped a portfolio, well, I am now associated with about six different organizations where I provide either facilitation, learning and development, or leadership coaching work. I'm also associated with a training organization where I coaching students and mark their coursework. And so coaching has really taken a much bigger role, and talent development has played a much bigger role in my life than it used to. And I just really love it. And I found that the combination of experiences that I've had, corporate setting as a recruiter, leading teams, leading cross-border teams, managing change, has given me a capacity for understanding and empathy, whether I am in a development workshop with a bunch of leaders looking at their corporate culture, or whether I'm coaching someone who's at the top of the tree and feeling intensely vulnerable. It just gives me a skill and an insight, a compassionate humanity that adds a ton of value. And so I'm still working out what this portfolio business is. It's kind of grown up around me without me consciously designing it. But what I have done, a bit like how I describe living in London, is listen to the signals that different experiences, different conversations, different work is giving me, and looked for the opportunities. And I mean, I joined EY because I knew it would be an organization that would present opportunities, and boy, was I right. I had about 9 different jobs in the time that I was there, and I loved it. I learned so much. Looking for opportunities doesn't stop just because you leave one particular organization. And so I do feel that is part of me, and I think it's part of what brings hope and meaning in my life, and finding ways that I can really contribute to an organization, to a leadership group, to an individual. And that's how this portfolio has grown up around me. One of the great joys it's given me, this is going to sound so corny, is so I can volunteer at the tuck shop at school, and I never had that experience. And it's just been so nice to be part of, making cheese toasties on a Friday morning and form a connection and network of other parents and a remarkable number of them are also expats. So it's got a real professional satisfaction, a real freedom to do the kind of work that I enjoy that has an impact, but also the opportunity to do beautiful things like, making kids sandwiches for the school.
Yeah, that flexibility is amazing. It is something that you have to learn to navigate, though, isn't it? Because you don't have the backdrop of a brand behind you or an immediate association with maybe a job title. And if that's something that we've always had in the past, we have to learn how to be ourselves professionally rather than the marketing director of, ABC company, and to rely on title. Are there any other sort of insights that you can share around, what you had to consciously, I suppose, navigate?
That's such a good point, Margot, because I think it took me some time to identify with the job and the organization that I'd worked for a decade and a half. And I don't think that's unique. I think that's pretty normal. But for somebody in my line of work, you think I would have got it much sooner. We're actually working with you, to be honest, helped me see the skills and abilities, the competencies, the achievements that were mine at that organization.com. And to really own and appreciate those and to talk about them. And look, I'm still working it out today. Like I said, I was updating my bio a couple of days ago and I realized, actually, I have done quite a lot that I hadn't actually presented here before. This is worth showcasing. So there is a lot about when you're attached to an organization, when you come a bit institutionalized, that you take for granted. And so learning to come out of that umbrella, as it were, and own your successes, own your achievements, own your failures, only experiences and the things that you learned, they were yours, and how they have shaped you and how you can go and contribute through those somewhere else. That took time, and it was a slow lesson. And I think for anyone who's leaving, particularly big organization, perhaps have been a big fish in a small pond somewhere else, I think we need to recognize that effort in de-identifying with what we've done. You are not your career, but you own these lessons from your career, and they're worth talking about. But I can't overstate, I mean, having someone to help me see those and craft a story around them in an authentic way was really invaluable. And I'm not here to sell you to other people, Margot, but
yeah.
I'm in the business.
Yeah.
I'm in the business of helping people with their careers. You can't get closer to this than I've been over the last 25 years. And yet being able to help me see what I didn't know and say what I hadn't shaped myself was really important to me, particularly when I wasn't plugging and playing in the same work, in the same type of organization. I actually consciously wanted to change. I needed to be able to talk about it and own the good bits and the bad bits. Hard to do on your own.
It is. It's like a detox, really, isn't it? Like when you come out and it's like, okay, well, you know, I'm a different person. You know, I'm looking at the world in a different way. So, you know, I think that's really critical. How do you feel about your sense of identity now?
Really excited. I don't know what will come and what will happen, you know, who does, but I know the difference I'm making to the clients and the organizations that I'm working with. I feel the joy and satisfaction that I get through the work that I do. I feel incredibly fortunate. I feel that our overseas experience has enriched me in ways that I'll still be discovering in years to come. And that this conscious choice to come back has been such a gift, but I've also had the gift of time to sit and think things through, to ask myself the questions that I ask my coaching clients, to hold the space, to, I don't know, meet people for coffee and form the connections, to go to Kmart at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday, you know, all those things that were just not part of my life before, and appreciate them. I feel like I'm rambling, but in terms of my identity, it's definitely shaping, but I feel like I've shed the cocoon and I'm excited about what's next.
Now, we like to finish all of our chats, if you like, with five quick questions. So I'd love to put those to you now. Living overseas taught me what about myself?
That I can handle it. Whatever bump in the road had happened, I thought, if this has come my way, I can handle it.
The number one skill that I use in my career or my portfolio today is?
Curiosity and connection.
The best thing I have discovered since being home is?
Well, I'm so glad you asked this. My library. I love, love, love my library. It is such a joy. But I have to mention, I spent 4 days walking in the rainforest on the scenic rim earlier this year. And my goodness, that was so profound and so beautiful. And just being in nature in that way, I don't think I've ever quite had that experience. So absolutely love my library. I'm down there every week, but I am so moved when I get out into the Australian countryside. It's just a joy to have that experience again.
Beautiful. The first thing I would encourage a new repat to do is?
Connect with like-minded people. They will become your lifest while you bob along and find your next port of call. I can't imagine just the idea of coming home and going it alone. There's just no need to these days. There are other people like you hiding in plain sight who will say, how are you? What do you need? Have you got a hairdresser, a physio? You know, all of those things. Go find those people, build your network, and they will support you as you bob along to your next port of call.
Yeah, I love it. I love that analogy. A word, song, or quote that best describes your time overseas is?
Might be two. My song is Magical Mystery Tour.
Oh, nice.
Because, my goodness, I couldn't have scripted most of what happened to me over the last 22 years. But there's another phrase that I really love that's on a card that I bought in Bahrain. And it said, see, nature doesn't hurry and yet everything is achieved.
Oh, beautiful. Patience.
Yeah.
And patience. Kindness. Yeah.
And isn't that what we've been talking about? Your patience and permission?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I've thoroughly enjoyed our chat and I really thank you for your time, Angela.
Thank you too, Margot. And thank you for being there for me from before I even left Bahrain to being part of the journey coming back. I really appreciate all that you do.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review, share it with your friends and family, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on our guests, please head to our website, insyncnetworkgroup.com, where you can check out the show notes and also find more information about our career advisory programs and fabulous community.